One foreign country and two U.S. presidential administrations. Professor Buzz Scher discusses the current controversy with Trump's conversation with Ukraine's President Zelensky. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, what happened with the intelligence community whistleblower?
So, let me kind of go back to the beginning. Apparently, some person in the intelligence community, don't know who it is, could be a member of the National Security Council staff at the White House, could be a member of the CIA, maybe the FBI, the NSA, don't know, became aware of a sequence of events. Apparently conversations, at least some of them conversations, that caused him or her grave concern on the language of the Whistleblower Act, urgent concern that something untoward was happening. And the Whistleblower Act allows for somebody to, quote unquote, blow the whistle out a person who is engaged in that kind of urgently concerning behavior. And their job is to report if they have that kind of concern. They go to the Inspector General and of the intelligence community. And the Inspector General is an independent body to investigate things like that, intentionally independent from the rest of the particular agency. And the Inspector General decides whether it was the issue raised is of urgent concern. That's mm-hmm. the Inspector General's job. And if so, the whistleblower statute authorizes the Inspector General and requires the Inspector General to report it to the intelligence committees in the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Which is how this became public knowledge, I'm assuming?
Well, no. The Inspector General checked with the interim head of the National Security Intelligence Apparatus, Mr. McGuire. I can't remember his first name, to be honest with you. McGuire overruled the Inspector General and said, nope, you can check with the Department of Justice, and I'm going to check with the Department of Justice to get advice on this, but I'm overruling you. I'm telling you not to report it. Mm-hmm. Now, the whistleblower statute does not give that person, the head of the NSI, the power to do that. And that's where so then the Inspector General said to Congress, I wanted to report this to you. I was overruled by my superior, mm-hmm. who consulted with the Department of Justice. So that's the process, and it was a first ever or a very unusual process that the Inspector General was not allowed to report the complaint from the whistleblower to the two intelligence committees. One of the interesting features about this that's gotten lost in the shuffle here is that the Inspector General was appointed by President Trump.
So this is one of those few instances in this administration where the person calling out is actually an appointee.
Fair to say, harder to make a claim that it's a member of the deep state, the so-called deep state, to the extent that the deep state exists. So that's why there was such a brouhaha.
Yeah.
It's that, one, there's a brouhaha because it's a whistleblower calling out the president on an issue of what the whistleblower, a member of the intelligence committee, thought was of urgent concern. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's obvious. That's the core worrisome issue. But more broadly, they subverted the process that the statute lays out for dealing with exactly this kind of circumstance. So that's what the mess was. What's now transpired, as I think many know, and certainly when this airs, everyone will know, the White House is now going to turn over a memo summarizing the phone call that President Trump made to President Zelensky of the Ukraine, number one. And number two, it appears from latest reports that they are preparing the complaint of the whistleblower for release to the intelligence committees of the Senate and the House. That appears, at least as of this morning, that appears that was going to happen too. So now the, and there's also information leaking out, and maybe the transcript, that memo that I've talked about, It's not a transcript of the phone call.
Right, it's a memorandum released by the White House.
Yeah, it's a standard memorandum that is done taking into account a number of people's versions of what was talked about, and it was a summary. So it's not actually, some people have reported that they were going to get the transcript, but it's that memo.
Yeah, transcripts, I'm assuming, don't exist to this conversation.
I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like anyone has said they necessarily exist. People have said we want the transcripts, but there's been no indication.
I would assume that a recording exists of that conversation from which a transcript could be made, but I don't know that anyone's made a transcript. Mm-hmm. So I would be a little surprised if the phone call was not recorded, mm-hmm. just as a matter of course. It wouldn't have been unusual.
Okay.
But I don't know whether there's going to be a transcript or not. One of the important pieces of this is, though, from what I've understand in the public reports, the whistleblower's concern was not just related to that one phone conversation in July. It was related to, I'm not sure whether to call it a sequence of events or a combination of events and conversations and information that the whistleblower was privy to, either firsthand or secondhand, that overall caused him concern. So in evaluating what's going on, I think it's important for people to understand, don't make a judgment just on what the memo said or the transcript right. said. There's really a broader context that needs to be fit into. So
yeah, everyone's focusing on this one conversation entirely when there seems to be more to it.
And that's why it's going to be important to see what the complaint that was filed says, which mm-hmm. would contain all the information from which the whistleblower and the inspector general drew the conclusion that it was an issue of urgent concern.
And I will put in the episode description a link to the memorandum, because it was released this afternoon. We're actually recording this in the afternoon of Wednesday, September 25th, 2019.
So now two things are going to happen. The Senate and the House Intelligence Committee will look into it, you know, and do what they may. They may formally publicize the complaint as well as the memo or not. I think there's some classified information issues that need to be sorted out right. in that regard. Independent of that, the concern that was expressed by many Democrats has led to a greater formalization of the impeachment process as yes. to President Trump. And my current understanding is that they are setting out to do a impeachment
right.
process. And the way Speaker Pelosi seems to be running it is this way. There are eight committees that are doing one kind of investigation or another into President Trump. And she is going to let those committees do their work and let them report their findings or their conclusions, be it in terms of articles of impeachment or more factual findings or conclusions, to the House Judiciary Committee, which is going to be the center point and where the formal impeachment proceedings will begin.
And which is kind of the normal place for that to take place.
Exactly.
Correct?
Exactly. And so what happens is once the House Judiciary Committee goes through its process, once they get all that they need, and it may well include things beyond this Ukraine mess.
Right. That's what's really going to be unique about this whole proceeding is there's more than just one aspect to it. In the past, when we've talked about impeachment with various presidents in the past, it's been basically around one sort of concept.
Nixon, it was the Watergate.
With this, there's so many different aspects that the Democrats have been wanting to kind of pin onto Trump.
And which raises this fundamental issue about impeachment. Though there is a formal process played out in the Constitution, it allocates the decision to impeach a president to the House of Representatives. And it allocates, once a person is impeached, they are not removed from office. Then there is a trial in the Senate.
Right.
The Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court presides over that trial. And only if there's a two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict the person of the charges that came from the House in their articles of impeachment, and I'll come back to that, only if there's a two-thirds vote in support of at least one article of impeachment is the president removed from office. So that's, and the articles of impeachment are the ultimate product of the House Judiciary Committee.
It's their findings, essentially.
It's the offense that we find these articles of impeachment in the, if we're to use the analogy of the criminal justice system, it's like an indictment.
Okay.
You know, we've sat as the equivalent of a grand jury. We've heard all this evidence, all these witnesses, and we have a majority vote that says we find that there is present these X number of articles of impeachment. And that's a majority vote. And that goes to the House, comes out of the House Judiciary, goes to the House as a whole. They vote. And then
what percentage of the House needs to sign
majority,
up?
Just majority. My understanding is it's a majority.
Okay.
And then it goes to the Senate,
which is going to be a problem for the House.
Yeah. The Senate is required to take it up. You know, there's been a lot of
evidence. No matter what, they have to take it up. Okay.
Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, cannot do what he has been doing relatively frequently and just not bring things forward.
Right.
He doesn't have that power. The rules say the Senate has got to deal with it one way or another.
Okay.
He does have a lot of power to structure the trial in terms of how many witnesses, how long, et cetera, et cetera. So he has a tremendous amount of power. And practically speaking, the Democrats, if all the Democrats voted in favor of removing Trump from office, if the House moved articles of impeachment to the Senate, they would also need 20 Republican votes.
Right.
They need 67 votes.
They hold the majority. That would be quite the feat at this point.
Yeah, depending.
Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of Republicans that will probably go along with it.
So
but
let me go back. And even though there's formal rules, like I've just described, and a formal process for impeachment, do not mistake that the impeachment process in full is a political process.
Right.
It's not about law. It's about politics.
Yes.
You can be impeached without ever having committed a crime. You can be impeached for whatever reason you can get the votes for, and you can be removed from office for whatever reason the votes are there for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 67 votes are there for. And there's more formal process in play in the criminal justice system if you're indicted, both before you're indicted and after you're indicted, and what a trial is. And we rely on that for the integrity of the system. It's such as our criminal justice system has a measure of integrity in how it deals with cases. It comes a lot from the very formalized, well-established, well-vetted process that's in place for every single criminal case. And we don't change the process depending on the individual. You know, that's a really important part of a system with integrity. The impeachment process, the rules are not, there's not a lot of rules other than what I've just described.
Right.
And so it is already very political, and it won't
right.
get any less political.
It's a different process, but it comes to mind what happened with Kavanaugh with regards to his appointment, where everyone's like, there was a lot of equating it to a criminal proceeding, when it's like, no, this was entirely just them wanting him to be on the court.
Yeah, they were giving him a privilege.
Yeah.
In standard fashion, some of the complaints about how unfair they were to Kavanaugh, to me, they should fall on deaf ears in that, wait a minute, he doesn't have a right to this. If he has a right to something, he should get due process.
Right.
But we're giving him one of the ultimate privileges in American public life, mm-hmm. being an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's not entitled to any set of rights right. or any set of due process concerns. So the impeachment process, there's more that the president will be entitled to as a matter of process.
Interesting. Okay.
Than Kavanaugh was entitled to. Mm-hmm. Kavanaugh wasn't entitled to any process,
right.
period. You know, as was shown with Merrick Garland, who was yes. the nominee of Barack Obama, he was entitled, he got no process.
Yeah, he didn't even get a hearing.
Right. So President Trump will get more in terms of process, but that doesn't, it won't get the formality and well thought out and deeply etched processes that are a part of the criminal justice system, such as they are. He'll get something less than that. And so there'll be much more of a risk and opportunity, both of politics being front and center at all times, which they will be.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.